Before we get started on today's show on affect theory in Mage, I just wanted to note that the conversation gets a little graphic describing the brutality of combat in the world of darkness, as well as how affect and traumatic conditions feed into each other. It only gets mentioned once or twice, but I didn't want to surprise anyone. If that's not your cup of tea, you may want to skip this one. Otherwise, on with the show. Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast, and my guest today is Jordan. Jordan is also joined by his puppy, Lola, so if you hear puppy noises, that's Lola. Jordan, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing good. Lola's sleeping under the desk right now, so that's good. She's adorable. She is looks like an angel while she's asleep. I'm good. I'm ready to talk affect theory. It's a theory that's near and dear to my heart. I've been a fan of this podcast for years, so I'm just real excited to get to actually be on it.
Gladly. Anyone who has something interesting to say and a microphone and will help me fill out a 7-page outline, I'm generally okay having on. So we're going to be talking about a few things. One is the idea of affect theory, which is a theory in psychology or in the social sciences that has also spread to a number of other disciplines. We're going to talk about the power of description in game. We're going to talk about kind of the relationship between feeling, emotion, mood, and affect, as well as how that factors in to the Ascension War. And one of my key things is always to point the conversation back at things that go into your game. So just to start off, Jordan, what is affect theory?
Affect theory is a lot of things. It's, as Terry has very helpfully pointed out, like it sort of has applications, not just psychiatry and therapy, but also literature criticism, like queer literature.
What is affect?
So affect is, at least for the purpose of what we're talking about here, affect is the pre-conscious reaction to visual stimuli that can nonetheless be socially constructed. So this is not the stimuli itself. It's the first order response to the stimuli. For example, you cannot prevent your affective reactions any more than you could will your heart to stop beating. An example that I often like to use is, like, let me ask you something, Terry. If you saw a grizzly bear coming towards you, you would definitely have like this instinctive fight or flight reaction, wouldn't you?
So one of the things that complicates this is I am an epiphenomenalist in general. I am generally of the opinion
What? I should have known.
Yes, secret closet epiphenomenalist. So I have had the experience where I'm like, I am terrified. Why? And then I have to do the looking. I was backpacking in Canada, in Manitoba, and I ran into a moose. And almost figuratively.
Honestly, and, equally, maybe more dangerous.
Yes.
And I'm not joking.
A moose is going to be 7 to 10 feet tall, depending on it. And it weighed probably about 1,300 pounds, which is a lot. And I was just dumbfounded. And before I even knew that it was a moose, I already had frozen in place and was like, and it took me a minute to realize that there was a furry tank in front of me. And then I'm like, do you run from a moose? I don't know how this is supposed to do. So I crab walked sideways behind a tree, and we all stood in a line behind a tree, just kind of waiting for this thing to figure out what to do. Yeah. So there was not necessarily, there was certainly that moment of terror, but the moment of terror preceded even realizing that it was a moose.
Yes. I was going to say you have to be kind of taught that a grizzly bear is dangerous in that, like, you're not born knowing what a grizzly bear or a moose is, or that a moose is dangerous. Otherwise, like, you know, it's sort of like if you see a wolf, you'd be much more worried than if you saw a St. Bernard, despite the fact that they are about the same size and could do the same amount of damage. Affect theory is also generally described as the biological part of emotions. Sylvan Tompkins has kind of this list of preconscious reactions that you can have to any visual stimuli, but I think that getting too hung up on exactly categorizing them can really kind of remove the magic from it, let's say. So suffice to say, it is the kind of hindbrain reaction to visual stimuli before you actually really think about it and put it into your narrative of how your brain works, let's say.
And affect are distinctly different from emotion.
Yes, emotion comes kind of afterwards. Emotion is the conscious you saw the moose, you had the frozen in terror part. You didn't know that you were scared until after the frozen in terror part.
And so the idea is you receive a set of stimuli, you have some sort of immediate or rapid fire bodily reaction. Your brain collects the stimuli, looks around and goes, huh, why is this happening? And it goes, probably has to do with that furry tractor with razor blades on its hands in front of me. I am going to choose to shit myself.
And it has, like, you know, a very good evolutionary reason, which is like, you know, if said furry tractor is moving towards you, you don't have time to contemplate the meaning of the furry tractoring towards you. Your brain just goes, run.
And in experimentation, we find that these reactions occur at the central nervous system. Like, they occur before it even hits the damn brain. Like, we don't, yes. It can occur at the spinal column. It occurs at the amygdala. It can occur at the hindbrain. And I do think the list is helpful. So the Sylvan-Tompkins system kind of goes through 9 different kind of families of it. And just to modify slightly something that Jordan says, this can be any of the sensory inputs. Visual is the most common, yes, as humans.
Well, smell is incredibly important,
yes,
for memory, for example. Smell is like an incredibly powerful, affective experience.
Yes. Anyone who's ever been like, I'm sorry, I can't have a second date with you, you wear the same perfume as my mother, will understand that's a thing. So you have distress, anguish, interest, excitement, enjoyment, joy, surprise or startle, anger, rage, fear, terror, shame, humiliation, disgust, and dissmell, which is disgust, but for your nose.
Yeah. And it's also kind of shades into contempt, interestingly, dissmell. Yeah. Definitely like the sixth ranger one of the
film. And as someone who worked in the kind of the sensory sciences, dissmell is pretty powerful. Anyone who's encountered thiols, the human brain is very good at being like, that's the smell of a dead thing. You should not be here.
And these can all shade into each other. And like for example, like anger, hate, plus distress, anguish, and fear, terror obviously can come right, can like all exist at the same time.
I think the important thing to think about affective responses is they're quick and pre-conscious, and it is difficult to notice it. And it happens before you've even noticed it. The conscious part of you, or the observing part of you that ties to, let's just say, our inner monologue, comes after it. And it may be one of those things that is impossible to notice without the use of time or mind or life, which I think could kind of become an interesting thing.
Interesting. It's like you literally have to put the effect before the cause.
Yeah. So I think it would be interesting to have the character that does that, some sort of instinctive time effect that they can tell in advance. I don't know what's going to go down, but I see 30 seconds from now, I have the fear terror response.
Yeah. That'd be great technocracy. I think that'd be great for technocrats.
Mm-hmm. It is also interesting for technocrats because the ability to directly process that would theoretically improve reaction time. Suddenly you have a justified improved initiative roll or something like that, or gain the jump on someone. So like, kind of what are the steps where it goes from stimulus to response?
There's the sensory input, which is the stimuli, which you get as Trace, it could be sensory, auditory, taste, anything. Then you get your physical response. And I find the physical response fascinating because I think a lot of times we assume emotional response goes before physical response. Like, I'm so angry, my heart, you know, I'm seeing red, so angry, you know, like, I'm so scared, the hair on the back of my neck standing up, and like, oh, I feel a spine tingling sensation. But often it's the other way around. Your heart starts beating faster and then you get angry. Your spine tingles, then you get scared, things like that. And this isn't to say that we are robots, that you can just turn it on and off, but that these sensations definitely put you into the mind of, like, it's like how anxiety disorders work, but you get these sensations of kind of a terror response, but you have no purpose for it, which then turns it instead into sort of this all-encompassing thing as your brain desperately looks for the stimulus that caused it. So these can be very powerful.
And we have some interesting data backing this in terms of looking at people that have dealt with various injuries or diseases where this response is broken. For instance, people with spinal cord injuries often do not have a terror response. They are not experiencing the bodily phenomenon of terror. And we have evidence of people with spinal injuries, for instance, walking in and finding a dead body and being like, well, that's weird, as opposed to freaking out.
Because you expect the freaking out to be accompanied by the spine tingling response, these physical sensations. And I want to put it that affect theory is very much a visceral sort of theory. It wants to look at sensations instead of just abstract emotions. It wants to talk about like someone being so scared they wet themselves.
And another avenue where I think this is kind of interesting is when we talk about the bodily experience preceding the emotion, I think this suddenly becomes a fascinating avenue for how do we discuss emotion with other entities that may not have the same thing.
Bodies.
Yeah. How do we talk with a chimerling about this, or a cyborg, or a ghost? Or a hyper-intelligent cephalopod that runs the progenitors with an intelligence of 9, but is only being held back by not having opposable thumbs.
I hate that guy. He's such a jerk.
Pardon me. Hyper-intelligent cetaceans, not cephalopods. That's a different hyper-intelligent thing in the progenitors. My mistake.
Operators.
One of the questions is, so how do we use this in our games? To me, one of the important things that I have tried to do more over time, once I kind of got familiar with this, is provide characters with a physical description of sense inputs and then ask what their character's initial response is. Ask the player to describe the steps of going from sensory input to emotion to the actual response. And to me, this is a great chance for characterization. So Marcus, master of the lost arts of Kalaripayattu, felt the excruciating experience of a Gokusari Gama plasma blade flaying the top layer of skin off of their right arm. They begin to bleed lightly, but the literal 50,000 degree Fahrenheit jet quickly cauterizes the wound and even melts some of the nearby hairs. And you can ask, how does Marcus react to this? You may need to break this down the first few times. Some players, when asked how they respond, will strictly describe their next move, but you're kind of asking them for their physical response before they do the game action. So you may want to ask something more specific. Maybe ask, what is your character's facial expression? Marcus screams for a moment and quickly turns to a laugh as he refuses to show pain in the face of this modern embarrassment. As a guru of one of the world's oldest known martial arts of Kalaripayattu, he's never steeped to such technical contrivances. And another question is, so how does the body respond? Marcus saw the torch coming. While he made no noise, the gritting of teeth and hair standing on end in a brief moment of tension clearly show how much the grazing blow stung. All the concentration in the world makes it very hard to prevent the pain response. And now there's a mental component. Marcus had a similar injury when learning the Urumi whip sword and its sharp, flexible blades. His knowledge of life, mind, and correspondence allowed him to track 31 of the blades in his mind's eye, but that 32nd one took a thin piece off of his forearm, which he later used to enchant the whip, using a bit of his own skin to entreat the whip to serve him. What does Marcus think of his surroundings? The plasma torch is impressive, but in a back alley full of ignitable trash, a quick inferno may level the playing field. What does he think of the spectacle? Stepping outside of himself for a moment, Marcus chuckles at 2 5-foot-6 Asian men facing off against each other, he in the simple robes of a Kerala Purohita squaring off against a hypertech ninja whose socks probably cost more than all of his worldly possessions combined.
In fact, this would be like a fantastic mind effect that could use affects as a way to sort of delineate. Like a normal person would just like not be able to think this through, but because of your supernatural, you know, awakened will, you're able to calmly like look around and like strategize your surroundings and whatnot, even while taking in all these, the pain and stuff.
And I think that's kind of a thing to do to your opponent. So this top layer of skin gets flayed off by Hypertech Ninja and your response is, ow. And then, part of affect is we are very good as people of interpreting other people's affect. We are not good at interpreting other people's emotions, but we are good at generally picking up those physical cues, even if they are not fully conscious.
Which would be great for life effects too. I think that, like, you know, asking questions like these will also allow you to, you know, kind of better frame the action direct activity in a more visceral and memorable way. When you're not just looking at it like little pieces on a board, but like you're describing all of these different sensations, you're really putting them in their place. I think smell is a great one too. So asking, how does Marcus feel about the indignation of this reverend child accosting you, you know, that'll get a different response than, do you feel Marcus's razor focus swerve in performing his oblations to Lord Mahesh, where he was interrupted by this odd fellow?
Yeah. It, one of those things that I use, especially at one-shots, is especially if a player does not understand the import of it, is saying things like, how do you respond to this indignity? Yes. Versus, what would you like to do in response?
Which is really good, because I think a lot of times they don't. Saying just, how, what do you do in response? Like, that gives too, it's kind of like when you overload someone with possibility by framing it as, oh, this indignity. People have felt, you know, embarrassed, or like someone's talking down to them before.
But as you mentioned, the importance of smell, like as you smell your own burnt arm hairs waft towards your nostrils and smoke come off of you, that is your top layer of skin and the sacred garments that you've had for over 200 years. How do you respond? We can bake that sensory information into framing the response. Some players will utterly bristle from this, but I have found that most like a little bit of direction.
I think it's good. As long as you're not telling them how to play their character, you're just telling them, like, this is the sensory information that they're getting. And I think that that gives a great opportunity for additional character building, because, like, you could have two Marcuses and they could react completely differently to the same stimuli.
And the nice thing about affect, as you mentioned, is they are rapid fire and they're frequently pre-conscious. So this is a opportunity for the character to fill in something, or the player to fill in something, without like it taking an action. Like we have, there are free actions in Mage, basically things that you can do without it consuming your action, especially during a combat turn. And being able to say, would you like to make a quick statement, or is there something you shout, I think is good.
I think that using affects as part of your paradigm would be really cool too. As like, you could say, you know, oh, I'm feeling this adrenaline come through, you know, come in me. And like, I'm going to use that to, you know, be able to make this life effect, which gives me higher strength, covert.
Think that's entirely reasonable, especially when you focus on the biological response, which is frequently rapid fire and justifiable. I think one of the things that came up which brought up the show idea was basically, how do we bake this into what magic feels like to use? And kind of one of the examples I was thinking of is three different characters use the Shadowlands as their way to explore the past. It is the realm of memory. And all three of them, when they delve into the Shadowlands, get a rush as if cold water is entering their veins. And Marissa is fond of this. She frequently sends her senses into the Shadowlands to talk to her deceased and ghostly grandfather, who first taught her how to do this when he was still alive. Every time she does, she gets a bit of nostalgia and associates it with this kind of cold embrace of the underworld. Marissa also does polar plunges, as she only has positive associations with this sudden chilling burst across her skin. Helen, the paranormal investigator, on the other hand, has a calming response to it. It reminds her of the cold air of the operating theater, her first career being that of a surgeon. It reminds her of the feeling of control she had doing orthopedic surgery, and she often puts on surgical scrubs before she does anything involving the Darklands. And Malika hates the cold. It reminds her of winter, something she never knew before her town was emptied out to make way for a uranium mine. She feels dead away from her homeland, and the rush of the underworld keeps her on edge. So this is focusing on the fact that all of these have the same physical stimuli, but wildly different emotional responses. And I think this is something that also goes like into game.
Affects have, you know, kind of general signs, and we can recognize them often, even if we don't actually list them. It's honestly probably part of, like, say, like the uncanny valley, when you see someone not have these effects, even if you couldn't list them, like, you just know, and it feels off-putting. So instead of a character freezing in fear on seeing your garbage elemental, you can say, as someone rounds the corner to the shambling mass of animated cardboard and food waste, your pursuer pauses before showing a frozen stare, or a pale face, or bursting into sweat with the hair on their arms on edge. I guess if you're very close to them.
Yeah. Or you're looking with your special eyes.
Yes, special eyes.
I would like to note, as I recently learned about the panniculus carnosus muscle, which is the muscle beneath the skin of most mammals on their backs that lets them twitch to shake off flies. It's how horses can just kind of like shake in the middle of the back to prevent a fly from biting them. And I want that. I feel like that would be very useful. Yeah. I like having opposable thumbs, but still.
I wonder when my dog does that. If like I pat him suddenly on the back and they'll see like little back twitch.
Yeah. Almost every mammal but us has it. And it's kind of frustrating. I don't know what we, yeah. I mean, sure, we've dominated the planet, but like really are we living if we don't have that weird muscle?
No, we're not. We're just existing.
You've talked about affect theory as regards other night folk. Where does it kind of come up for you there?
So I think I'm going to go at this from a mage perspective, where I'm assuming that you're playing mages. So this is going to be kind of from an exterior look at these. So like if you see a werewolf, like I would imagine that their biggest visible affect is going to be rage, right? It's so potent that they call it like, you know, the curse. Like people get freaked out being around them too much. That is a heck of an affect thing. You could see them breathing heavily when their rage is coming to the fore, even if they're just acting normally, like, and seem relaxed to themselves. Like they could have this effect that they look like they stare at you kind of like an animal or like a wolf sizing you up rather than like most people do. I think most people, for example, avoid eye contact too long. I could see a werewolf just staring at you until you look away.
I also like the idea that you can posit a supernatural world where it's like, yeah, these are the nine affects that mortals or sleepers know about. There is also a delirium, kine, chimera, and shadow response that occurs at a pre-conscious level and kind of explains why people don't talk about the supernatural as much. Almost everyone has these affective responses. And it turns out the people that don't turn and run from the delirium, it's not because they have a willpower of nine. It's because in the same way some people don't have a terror response or some people don't have a dis-smell response, there could be some weird gene that they lack and they don't run in terror from werewolves.
That could be a theory for the technocrats, at least. They don't know about kinfolk. But yeah, another good one, of course, vampires, right? Especially when you look at the Sabbat passive. This is a bit of like one of the vampires, but like when you look at passive enlightenment, it talks about how they become visibly inhuman and disturbing and have, they call it like, I think, bearing in V20. So you're going to look at how they act inhuman in a way that puts other people on edge. It literally penalizes their social roles. So things like forgetting to breathe as their humanity erodes. Things like they're like, you know, you were talking about getting close enough to see the hair on their arms go on edge, like their hair never on edge. They're them becoming visibly fixated when blood becomes visible. They're them being weirdly quiet, I could imagine, because again, they forget to breathe. There's just like, there's this lack of the little movements and things that we take for granted that would be absolutely terrifying to see.
Would you see that happening also, for instance, either with people with high resonance, high quiet, or high arete?
For arete, I definitely think it would depend on their paradigm. I feel like, you know, as their arete goes on, they're going to want to more embody their paradigm, even though I think in Masters of the Art, it kind of paradoxically says they stop learning about, caring about paradigm as much. Yes, with quiet and resonance, I always imagine that as not necessarily being, do you mean like resonance on behalf of the person, like affecting that person's effective presentation?
Yes. So someone has three dots of morbidity and they just don't show the terror response anymore.
I think Vormas would be very disturbing to be around, for example. Yeah, like someone that deep in Jor, for example. Like, yeah, like they're just full dead to the world in the sense that it becomes difficult to describe this because we're talking about a lack of affect. But that's also terrifying, like seeing someone just stare at the worst possible actions is very intimidating in its own right.
And I think this is something that also we as people encounter with certain jobs. Like after a critical amount of time in medical device design, we could comfortably all eat lunch while looking at a presentation on wound care. It could be like, oh, wow, that's a pretty deep one. Do we have any more potato chips? So
but you have to build that or
yeah,
else,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know.
But I think that that is something notable that you're talking with your attaché, who is a mage, coroner, or medical examiner, and you show the picture of the cultists who were eviscerated by something. And it could go either way. One, this person did not react. This is a stone-cold sumbitch, to use the technical term. Or alternatively, this still got a rise out of someone who you presumed after looking at hundreds of corpses would have no response. I'm going to go back and record a content warning for this episode.
Oh, jeez.
So, note to self.
Free. I was like, oh, Terry.
I think it's reasonable. It is.
I meant you went too far. Yeah, content warning, great.
Yeah.
Content warning, great.
Two things that we discuss, response to death and epiphenomenalism. You should always get a content warning for both of those.
It is fair. Like, it's easy to just think, oh, it's just about emotions and feeling things. But, like, these are very, very powerful things. Like, I could imagine if you went deep enough into a response to delirium, like, that could absolutely require content warning because you're talking about an abject sort of terror that is unimaginable, I hope, to most of us. So awful that your mind blanks it out to save you from the memories and the trauma of it.
So kind of any other thoughts on affect theory in terms of like character presentation before we talk about affect theory and say magic?
I think an interesting one, I'd love to go on. I think you could do like so much about affect theory in different World Darkness ones, but particularly Wraith. Because it's such an interesting dichotomy that they are literally made of emotions, passions, you know, fetters, all this, yet they have no bodies. They're made out of plasm. And I think that's, I could just see a technocrat having a ball with that and just cocking a ghost into a harrowing just by going like, you make no sense.
Yeah.
This is dear bullshit. Get out of here.
I also think it's interesting because, again, not having the body, you don't have that set of responses. And this could probably also occur in Vampire, that you lose a lot of those cues, except for the cues tied to the beast. I've always thought that Wraith was an interesting meditation on identity because of things like Moliate and Soul Forging. The notion of identity...
Amnosynthesis.
Yeah, is very hard to confirm. You almost have this perpetual Copgross delusion that you have no emotional response to a person. There are no set of keys that tell you who they are, except for those that you've been able to observe over time. The complete loss maybe of affect, or alternatively, maybe that is one of those things that you can use to intuitively determine someone's relative level of pathos and angst. Because I imagine if there were affective responses for Wraith, the response of the psyche and the shadow are going to be laid over each other.
To put this into a way that we can make, like, use it for a game, I've always generally imagined that Wraiths generally do show the same affects that we do, unless they're really old. Because even if they don't actually have blood, or if they don't have a spine to tingle, like, they've been doing, they're just used to that being the way it is. And that's how they remember their bodies working. Otherwise, I imagine that they have muted kind of feelings, except when it comes to their passions, in which case it's very, very powerful. Like, they're getting so much power from these memories that it lets them break the wall between life and death and punch someone.
And I kind of like the idea of using that to inform resonance, because I think that if someone has a compassionate or healing resonance, that their affective responses are going to be ramped up. That when this person is interested in something that, so someone with three dots of analytical resonance, when they look at something, when they show that interest response, which is solicited by focused eye contact and leaning forward, it could literally be the case that the object that they are focusing on gets slightly more illuminated. You could see a literal glow in their eyes.
When you're focused on that person, focusing on you suddenly becomes the most important thing in the world. It's interesting with Wraith is, like, have you ever seen that meme of the Doom guy from Doom when it says, like, breaking news, man literally too angry to die? That's Wraith. You can literally be too angry to die, and that's your character backstory.
I also like the idea that someone is a harbinger of music, so they have two dots of melodic resonance, so they're almost always showing some sort of joy or distress response depending on like what key their resonance is. The person is always smiling, not necessarily in a menacing way, but one of those people that constantly can smize and just kind of radiate a certain kind of joyfulness from them.
You got resting glad face.
Is that a thing?
It is now.
Nice.
It's just someone who always looks happy.
Yeah.
I could imagine.
I'll certainly take it. Yeah, I like the idea of being, when a character gets a dot of resonance, that you say, hey, this is a way in which it changes affect either in you or tends to instill it in other people.
maybe even to a supernatural degree at high enough levels.
I wish there were kind of like the mists and mage that made those things kind of go away. But until that happens, I'm okay with just doing a little bit of hand waving so it can still be there. How about we talk about affect as it pertains to magic?
I think affect theory can be used in a couple ways. One is that you can say, hey, this is the world work, how the world works. And you can use that to obviously inform your practices. By that, I mean using it mechanically. For example, I think, Terry, this one was one of yours. It's like, if epiphenomenalism is the idea that emotion is the brain making sense of bodily sensations, does that mean that you can use forces to wrench someone's face to cause sadness by making them frown?
Yeah, I would be perfectly fine with that. Or using life to cause a chemical change, which induces a mood modification, and suddenly it's not just mind.
On low level, one would probably be like, do the daredevil thing where like you can hear someone's heartbeat and see if they're lying or not.
Yeah, I like the idea of trying to shake the confidence of a syndicate informant. Even if you don't want forces to be able to use mind effects, suddenly you can disrupt a business meeting by instilling the audience with this affect of boredom, by kind of instilling telekinetic muscle twitches in a bunch of the audience, or suddenly making the room water cold, which forces people to kind of itch and fidget and move around or try and brush something off them. And this makes
make everything staticky.
Yeah. And the presenter suddenly thinks the audience is bored, and we've gotten to the same place as a mind effect. Mind you, this would require more successes, but one of the beauties to me of mage is that you can get to the same place a bunch of different ways.
And of course, this another is that a character could employ affect theory to justify effects. So, for example, a character alters another's mood by simply causing the physical changes that could cue off an emotional change. You could model certain behaviors like laughter or sadness to spread that emotion in a group as others are swayed to emulate them. Break effective triggers to make it so that sensory experiences that trigger response don't. So you can block pain in another character just by having just dropped a book on their foot. So you can still make that good first impression.
Without that pain response, someone's like, oh, that's weird. There's a book on my foot. Let me pick that up for you.
Yeah, like the rom-com thing where meet cute, where it's like, oh, I spilled coffee on you, but I'm going to block the pain response so this hot coffee doesn't actually really hurt you.
Yeah. I like the idea that there is something called hyperaffect within maybe some sort of pseudoscientific or hyper-rational group, that instead of what the nine axes that Tompkins references, maybe they've theorized that there are 29 affective axes and has codified 400 bodily responses. And you can kind of scan surface thoughts by looking at someone for an extended period. The other thing that I like about it as someone who is trying to look into this is affect theory, like any academic discipline that is applied to a wide variety of areas, has a remarkable amount of highly specialized knowledge and strange definitions that if you rattle them off in rapid fire succession, makes amazing techno babble. I'm sorry, yeah, Jordan.
I'm not even talking about intensities.
Yeah.
Like that's a whole other thing I could go into.
You could also use it to justify physical actions. We have stories of people being able to do great feats of strength when they have enough adrenaline. You suddenly use life to get your blood and adrenaline pumping enough that you can lift a car off someone else. Weird, sure, but everyone has heard stories of the mom lifting the massive thing and you just kind of sweat it off. It's like, no, this is just an affective response. This is no stranger than me brushing a fly off my shoulder.
Yeah. And then if someone sees it, it's like, well, that's weird, but everyone's heard stories like that. So it's weird, but not unbelievable.
Yeah. I always felt like I'm never quite sure if that set should also count as being a hyper narrative, like the technocratic or technomantic equivalent of a mythic thread, like if urban legends or something like that should count, or if it should just be coincidental.
Is it for, or if we're in a mage game, I would make it coincidental because I want my players to be able to do a cool thing. And if they come up with that, like that's a really cool idea.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'd be like, I'm going to reward you for that.
Yeah.
I think you would have to definitely do a discussion with mind versus life, because I feel like this could involve life taking a whole lot of mind stuff.
Or repeating it. I think my general rule would be something that you could do it, but it would be one sphere level higher, and it would be probably one or two levels more difficult.
I would also make it much cruder. Yes. Like you're looking at like lizard brain things. You can't make someone like your sales pitch a whole lot on all these different things, but you can make them happy while hearing.
Yes. It seems like a great justification to make a social role easier. To me, it is not a great justification to just succeed at the thing where suddenly you're using life and forces to dispose the audience positively towards you or negatively towards someone else, which makes it easier when you roll a manipulation plus empathy or manipulation plus art or performance or something like that.
Again, I still think it's a lot of fun to play with. That's good, which is great. And of course, mind can work with affects as well. You can use it to even be more aware of these affects. You can do kind of create this kind of duality where you could be outside of yourself and, you know, kind of only show the affects that you want people to see when your mind thinks differently. Great poker player. You can have a great poker face that way. Let's say
that was kind of an effect that was introduced and revised more or less, this combined mind life effect where you were able to completely insulate yourself from response, and it made it one, you were way worse at coming across as personable. But the side effect of this was the theory kind of was that when a vampire uses dominate or presence or something like that, it is making a hyper modification to your affect. And by cutting yourself off from that, it allowed you to insulate yourself from those effects.
Yeah.
I can't remember what book it was originally in and revised, but it was basically the name of the effect was like stoic. Or something like that.
As an aside, affect is generally very skeptical of the idea of a mind and body like difference. For example, Brian Massumi, who is a very prominent affect theorist, refers to himself as a body because he sees the brain as just another part of the body. So you could have very interesting paradigms with that. You could be like, mind shouldn't even exist as a sphere.
That could be an argument that is waged within a group within the game. The idea that the mind is simply what the brain does, that it is a set of physiological and chemical responses. And it just so happens that as of now, the mind sphere is a better way to deal with it. But over time, the domain of the life sphere could be influenced so that it works in the same way that we have the primal utility sphere, which is dueling with prime for supremacy, or the way the data and correspondence spheres are kind of fighting each other for domain.
You know, that sounds like a part of using affect as some kind of war tool.
Mm-hmm. And this is something you kind of brought up originally when we were talking about it. I'm like, we could use it to describe a better way to have a chantry. And you're like, no, Terry, the Ascension War is fundamentally a conflict about affect. And I'm like, go on.
Well, it's changing the environment to reflect an affective environment. And I mean, this sounds magical. And I mean, this is mundane things being done to a magical extent. Everyone tries to make their environment feel comfortable, or you want this place that you don't want to be pleasant, you want to make it feel bad.
So you kind of brought up two parts of it. One was that they make an argument. One is a rational argument, while the other one is an affective argument. And the place this immediately went for me was how a faction within Mage arranges its internal space to create a set of responses. When you visit a chantry or magical place where one is welcome, the space is trying to put you in an affective mood. It's trying to give you all the cues and stimuli to hopefully be persuasive about what the host is advancing, as well as to get you to behave in a certain way. This can be used atmospherically to convey an idea or literally as a focus.
I mean, in character, you want it to express themselves, express why their reaction is right, why their argument, you can say rational argument is right, through an effective space that like shows, that puts them at, that puts people in a mood to regard that argument as correct. And out of character, of course, you want this space to, again, make that argument. You want it to speak about themselves.
So you are both conveying information to the character and information to the player.
Set dressing.
So a character visits an ashram or a monastic place, and they expect it to be utterly plain. But an awakened practitioner will also recognize that the place is selling their paradigm. The realm of the transcendent now smells lightly of apple blossoms. Because of how stark the environment is otherwise, this simple smell is all-encompassing. Simple designs stand out. The lack of external distractions and silence may result in very simple food being absolutely delicious. Don't you want to go to this unhurried place where you can simply drink in sensational pleasure in the most basic of acts? This could simply be good design, or a subtle mind to effect make you more inclined towards the request these monastic mages are about to make of you.
it's easy to assume that like these monastic places, we want to have as little stimulus as possible, because the stereotype is always, oh, you know, calm, not being focused on any extraneous details. But actually, like if you go too far with that, you could actually use that like a sensory deprivation tank, and that could lead to people becoming panicked or afraid.
Yeah, I like the idea that this group is going to ask you to engage in negotiations with them, and the negotiations take place in a sandbox, and you're simply sitting on perfectly white sand surrounded by perfectly white marble under a perfectly white sky. And without this input around you, meaning starts to decay. Suddenly, this is a focus for an Entropy 5 effect, where the lack of affective input to lead to emotion, to lead to thought, is simply not there, and the character can't even think cogently. A business focus group may wish to convey power and wealth, so their offices are both opulent and hectic. This could be a subtle way to hide a time 3 effect, where yes, things are literally happening twice as fast there, but the absolute array of visual clutter makes this hard to key in on. If there are 17 calls and everyone is running around, but not superhumanly fast.
It's just that good.
Yeah. You could have a hermetic practitioner who is in a environment of densely overlaid symbols and sigils that a character feels they could understand just kind of given time. This fixation makes your character take a simple set of goetic inscriptions, explainer one or two drawings, as an acceptable payment for whatever task this Bonnie Sage's mage is going to ask instead of the grimoire that you originally wanted. So the description of the environment, mages are going to generally notice that in any place there are two audiences, the people who are using the space and it is theirs, and the people who are visiting the space. And I think this can be something that, as you mentioned, can vastly improve the quality of our set dressings.
They want them, they want to feel comfortable to themselves, and they want to appear powerful to other people. Even if, like, not consciously, but they definitely would, you know, if you have someone come in, like, you want to look like this is your place.
You made mention that the factions are also waging not just a rational argument, but an affective argument. They are trying to give you the cues and indications that they are right. What does that look like to you, Jordan?
I think marauders are kind of the simplest ones, because they get to skip a step. They just do it. The Nefandi, I believe, are more subtle in the sense that it's very hard to have an affective. They got a real hard argument to make on a rational level, because their argument is the world is so terrible that it should end, generally, or that everyone's worst impulses should be allowed because things are so crappy that it's like, what, just another pile of shit, right? That means that they really have to work effectively. You can't just go up to someone and sell that, generally, right? You have to make them feel so despairing or numb that they just stop caring. I think that there are ways to do it. You can either do it through overwhelming people with stimuli, could do it. You know, you got like social media. God, I'm going to sound like a boomer with this, but like when you look at social media, how it, like, you just flip through all these things happening and you just become numb to it. And they are indeed kind of built and structured in a way for you to have these affective reactions to the point where you become exhausted. I think that that is a thing that Nefandis could do.
So you're kind of talking about like kind of two different sets. One, you have the people who are the goat kids that you and I both love and are the secret powerhouse.
Oh, so much.
Yeah.
So much.
Are trying to create a world that says giving into your worst impulses is actually quite good. And they set up the festival scene that shows that this is good. You're letting go. Society doesn't have anything on you. This is safe. This is fine. This is all fun. The man just doesn't want you to have. Whereby an exe or someone else that is trying to kind of preach global destruction is just going to inundate you with the 10,000 things that are bad about the world. You find this character's lair and it is just covered in newspaper clippings of repeated horrific things that are happening day after day. And the character says, you want to save this?
It could be like, hey, look at all these things caused by climate change. It's all going to be over in 20 minutes. Why in 20? Jesus Christ. Yeah. Watchman right there.
I did it 35
in 20 years. He could be like, you know, like rightly or mistakenly, like it does, they'll lie. It does. They're not going to tell the truth, but they're going to say like, you know, this is all going to be over. It's going to be more awful than you can imagine. Let's just get it done like quick and painless.
Where do you see the technocracy taking this kind of affective space?
So the technocracy, I think, are actually the surprisingly more interesting one to me, because the assumption is going to be like, they want everything to be safe, predictable, normal. So you'd think that they'd be pretty boring with it. They want everyone to just kind of be like a six. They want everyone to either be like, you know, a six or a four or a five, like in the middle. But I actually think that they would be very invested in the use of effective conditioning, especially the NWO, to influence both sleepers or technocrats.
What is effective conditioning?
You're using effective responses to basically influence their behavior. Think like if you've ever read 1984, think like the 2 minutes hate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, think of that. Or imagine if you want to teach someone to like hate, or sorry, as like training, they want to very quickly make you hate traditionalists. So they do like a Clockwork Orange thing, but it has padding, so it's fine. And then they just do these very fast, like hyper conditioning, like images and footage of like all the awful things that traditionalists have done in like 400 years in like 4 minutes. And so then when next time you see a traditionalist or a reality deviant, you're like, oh, these guys are monsters. You have that hate, anger, you have that hate, disgust, anger, rage, fear response when you see, next time you see one.
And this is something that they're going to be using in communicating with sleepers as well, where suddenly you see a flip between high gas prices and a whole bunch of indigenous peoples trying to hold up the Dakota Access Pipeline. You see something talking about murder rates juxtaposed with these weird religious cults that are practicing who knows what. I don't know what it is because it's not mainline Protestantism and thus wrong.
And you never have to use magic for that.
Yeah. Or it can be used as the focus for that massive mind effect.
Yes.
Or massive entropy effect, if that's what you want it to be. But just kind of that set of juxtapositions. And it's moving fast enough that you don't have the ability to summon the emotion, but you certainly have the time to notice the visceral, as you had mentioned, and immediate response that you have to those images and juxtapositions.
You don't have to take time to think like, why do I hate this mage so much? Because your training is also going to tell you that they're bad. They're going to explicitly tell you that they're bad. And then they're going to give you this thing. So it's like, oh, well, I feel hatred towards this person. So that must be right.
And I also like the idea that if you are dealing with low-level officials like comrades and sympathizers and so on, that this is affective training. Your character tries to use mind to influence them, and it just doesn't work. Or it's very difficult that not until you include life in this are you able to cut that affective association training in the same way that you just can't affect vampires without including matter, or you can't do certain things against werewolves without including the sphere of spirit that very low-level T0 technocrat officials, you need to include a little bit of life in there, otherwise it's not actually going to work.
You see, you're having a lot of fun with that as a PC, like as player technocrats, or as having technocrats as NPCs. Like, I could really imagine like these T0 people being given like, oh, here's this little like introductory video, like a YouTube video, but it's like the secret YouTube that only we know about. And it's just like, welcome to this time. You know, here are all these things, you know, here's all the protocols that you'll have to follow. Now you're in your new family. And then like there's these little subliminal messaging flashes of like, you know, of like symbols of different traditions. And it's like, you know, deny, reject, sort of those things.
So we've talked about how the technocracy may use this. I keep deleting things like that. The technocracy may use these against mages. How do you see them using it against like night folk? Or how do your characters use it when they're the technocrats and they're like, well, we can't take out this den of vampires by ourselves. How do we get the mortals to kind of do this for us?
Yeah. So an example that I thought of is you're playing a group of technocrat PCs. You're trying to flush out a hostile vampire faction in a city. You know, it could be Sabbat, Camarilla. You're not going to know. All you know is there's a lot of vampire, too many vampires in there. Too many.
Too many vampires.
Too many vampires. And instead of having to look for a vampire, which could leave you vulnerable, because you know enough to know that like vampires do not like people looking into their stuff, right? And they got their fingers in everything. Use their sort of biological needs against them. So your group can use contacts and local media to discourage sleeper presence in areas that are known to be kind of vampire feeding sites, forcing the vampires to move away from areas where they are most familiar and powerful, and in places where they could be vulnerable if they want to feed. You know, like, so for example, like there's this cool nightclub that vampires have a herd in, right? What if you're suddenly there's all these newspapers and like videos, like social media videos could be like, oh my God, there's like cockroaches in the food. Look at this. Look at, there's like mold in this. There's mold in the bathroom in this cool nightclub. It's like, oh, it's disgusting. And not even like the cool, dangerous, like danger type of thing that could be exciting. It's just like, this place is old and gross. Why would you ever want to be here? right? Get them to get people to move out. They don't like that place anymore. And, you know, it's same with like a restaurant that say, you know, some vampire controls and like they used to look for people they could feed from after eating. Maybe they're like one of those weird venture where it's like, I like the taste after they eat a good Italian, you know, a succulent Chinese meal. And again, get them to move out of their normal things. And it's very basic, doesn't even require any adjustments, any magic, just knowing people.
And suddenly you're bleeding away some NPC's herd background or forcing them to be like, hey, this other spot is something you could do. And it happens to be what is operated by the Syndicate Underworld or is a progenitor front. Or alternatively, oh, it happens that this other nightclub is overseen by this by the Giovanni or some adversarial group that they just don't want to have to deal with. And suddenly you have a vampire turf war and you take out two birds with one scone.
And you know where, yeah, and then you basically have like, you've removed them from their places where they know where everything is, where their havens are close by. The vampires generally don't like unpredictability, I think. Like in the books, like they generally like to be in control of things. So it makes them sloppy.
How would you see the traditions using this?
So the traditions want a diverse world where different ways of seeing are accepted, even if that might result in more unpredictability, right? So I think they'd be less concerned about having direct control over how exactly you feel. But I think that they would want you to familiarize yourself with different strange things. So an apprenticeship might involve teachers familiarizing their students with unfamiliar stimuli and make it easier for them to work with other traditions. And obviously not to the point of abuse or anything like that, but just, hey, you're going to come to this ritual, which a dream speaker group is doing, even though you're a virtual adept. And maybe they don't see the point, but it's because there's a lot of weird things in this world now. I don't want you to immediately react with fear and uncertainty at seeing things that you're not familiar with.
Yeah, you're trying to do your effect where you're co-locating into the digital web, but someone is helping you in their way, and suddenly you smell this weird mixture of fermented berries and maybe a little bit of blood, and we need to make sure that's not going to weird you out.
Yeah, because if you're in the digital web or anywhere and like some weird spirit comes out, I can't have you suddenly be distracted because somebody's doing something in an unfamiliar way that could get you killed.
Mm-hmm. And I could certainly see the technocracy for their agents doing this in a much more directed way to be like, hey, based on our analysis, we need you to associate a slight feeling of electricity and a taste of chocolate in your mouth as a pan-dimensional entity coming over and not you associating it with a joyous childhood, having a Hershey bar while rolling around on a segment of carpet. So
love the idea of ordering someone to have an effective reaction. That's great NWO internal things. Just like react to Freddy Krueger with happiness.
I have no doubt that they have figured out ways of doing that. God bless sleep teaching.
I think the iterators are interesting because I imagine they skip the effective conditioning and all that. I think they want that shit to just be on a switch. I think they would have cyborgs, they'd have like implants where it's just like, did you react to that with hate, disgust? Boop, now you don't. Is your heart beating fast? Boop, now it's not. Like they just skip the central nervous system part and they are just like, yeah, you could just choose to not react to this in a way that appears like fear.
Yeah, we have the updated DEI. Originally, there was basically a thing where they removed a portion of your brain to put this computer in. And I could see that being the original place where that was done.
It looks like you're very frightened right now. Would you like to not be?
I mean, that's one of the lovely scenes in, what was it, First Contact, where it's like, Captain, yeah, I'm experiencing fear. That's terribly inconvenient right now. Doop! Data.
Yeah, he does like a little neck twitch. Yeah.
Are there any other cases where you kind of see this come up or alternatively as maybe an argument that occurs within the game between players and gaming factions?
Well, this gets real abstract here, but I mean, this is Mage. So we're told that the Ascension War is about belief, but how does one separate belief from a feeling? And we are told that faith is about believing something rather than knowing it, which implies a categorical difference. I guess I'm saying kind of like the pop culture definition of faith, where, you know, when you ask someone, it's like, how do we know that this thing is real? Well, faith is just about believing.
And not in the sense of, I have faith that my mom's going to pick me up from soccer practice.
Sometimes that requires faith.
Yeah.
My mom's a huge Mage fan. I can't let her hear it. Can you then believe something without consciously knowing it? And what does that imply with the state of consensual reality? In other words, does this mean that a huge chunk of the consensus reality is based off of affective reactions to stimuli that are preconscious?
And now we have this preconscious ascension war.
That's totally crazy. Maybe that's why the antediluvians are still around. Maybe that's why you can't believe them out. Because it's just they've made a lizard brain impact on people.
And I like the idea that battles of the Ascension War are conscious, but the landscape of the Ascension War is subconscious, to come up with some sort of metaphor that would be used. Or alternatively, those affective responses, those preconscious things, are what defines the penumbra. And now we have a direct...
good paradigm. Again, that could be our hypothetical affect theory paradigm, where they could be like, oh, well, this doesn't make sense to you, but... I know that the reality is actually defined by preconscious affects that I know about. So that's how I'd work my magic.
And kind of based on that, this kind of implies that a large portion of the Ascension War is hiding your hand from what you're doing from the other factions. And now your mage turned on to this is seeing signs of conspiracy everywhere. The Union has a strong vested interest in appearing omnipresent and monolithic, and the traditions want to look like their fingers are behind everything, or alternatively, the technocracy sees them everywhere. And one, I think this is an amazing avenue to introduce quiet.
It would be very frightening.
Yeah, and it's hard to disprove. It's not like they're telling each other this. This is kind of a game of a war of branding and positioning. And I like kind of assuming that the traditions have figured that out finally, that they've started to use some of the Syndicate's tools against them.
I think a cool way to really present this in play is to make it is, first of all, if you feel be okay with it, be careful where you look. But if you look at how conspiratorial-minded people look and then how they see seemingly mundane events or environments as signs of the great hidden hand behind everything, whichever that is, depending on the conspiracy, that can really up kind of the horror factor or the kind of anxiety there. So it doesn't matter if the guess is right or wrong, right? That's not important. So, for example, a hospital could have some iconography that looks similar to that progenitor amalgam we fought against. Mm-hmm. Of a year ago.
Yeah, they have a slightly modified Caduceus or something like that. Yeah. Or their wand of Asclepius is digital with the snake having ones and zeros or something.
Equipment has this interesting brand, Pentex.
Yeah.
And the people working at that new TV station, they move stiffly and emotionlessly like NWO operatives. But keep in mind, that may just be from the perspective of the subject. They could be wrong. In fact, if you straight up tell them, yes, you're right, or no, you're wrong, that kind of ruins it.
Yeah. I like the idea of asking a character or asking the player how they associate certain things with other magical groups. You had a character who spent a lot of time with progenitor malefactors, who simply does now not trust doctors. And now whenever they see a white lab coat, their skin crawls and their heartbeat jumps. And it doesn't really matter the context. It could be Professor Actually, a wacky alternative theorist, and they don't care because they've done this.
Oh, Professor Actually.
Yes, the embodiment of the internet. Alternatively, after 6 years of apprenticeship to a bibliomancer, the character handles all books reverentially. They don't like seeing creased spines, or alternatively, they love a book that has signs of wear.
Have you ever been in a library?
Are you familiar with the Japanese term for the sudden desire to have to go to the bathroom upon entering a bookstore?
I like that these examples, by the way, also draw in. They're not just supernatural. I like that these are taking the supernatural and putting them in the mundane, sort of quote-unquote, sleeper world. So it's not like you can ever really separate the two, even if someone, a mage, might want to be like, I have my mage life and I have my normal life. You'll find them bleeding into each other.
And I also think it's important that these are opportunities for characters to just kind of make things up about mm-hmm. their past. And I think it's important to give each character the same sensory input and allow them to respond differently. The idyllic overdrive oscillator allows a simple Studebaker to break the sound barrier with its clean lines and simple forms of ray gun gothic or streamlined modern style. Does one character bristle at the kitsch and is another reminded of their childhood, which may incline them or disincline them towards the creator. These are great opportunities for characters to just kind of make things up and to talk about how that sensation goes through memory to form an emotion. We've kind of worked through our outline. Do you have any other thoughts on this? Or alternatively, if people are like, this is kind of cool, where do you think someone should start their journey of discovery?
Oh boy, I'm trying to think where I started mine.
I was in the affect store.
Yeah, I was in the affect store one day. I looked at Sarah Ahmed's The Cultural Politics of Emotion, and it's a fascinating book about how feelings that we have, which are often, you know, kind of talked about like on an individual basis, are actually spread around people and are kind of in this network of associations that you have attached to those emotions. So, for example, like, you know, you go to McDonald's, you have a good time there. Now when you see emotion, now you see McDonald's, you feel happy because you associate those two with it. And how social and cultural practices work to kind of construct those feelings. Look at nostalgia, for the simple marketing of nostalgia. It's a very easy one.
Nostalgia is a hell of a drug.
Nostalgia is a hell of a drug. Where, like, you see people complaining about Star Wars nowadays, and it's always like, that's not my Star Wars. And it seems like everyone has their own Star Wars that will, because I think the point is just they have these memories that are associated with these very important emotions, but can nonetheless never really be recreated. So that was kind of what got me into it.
The one that got me into the topic, which made me hit up Jordan for this conversation after Jordan had done an interview on Werewolf the Podcast, which we also include in the show notes, talk about a game that cares about affect. Mine was How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain by Lisa Feldman Barrett, who basically says we need to separate the stimuli from the formation of emotion, that is a posterior thing where we come up with a narrative or we integrate it in with our memories. And she talks extensively like about how bad we are at interpreting other people's emotions, but generally, we can interpret positive and negative affect with pretty good accuracy. But anything more specific than that, without a lot of cultural understanding, without familiarity with the person, it gets quite hard. And the example they use is they flash a picture of a Black woman and it says, what is this person feeling? And people write anguish or terror or horror. This person's obviously just lost something. And then they zoom out and it's like Serena Williams winning her first Grand Slam or something like that. Like, obviously suffering is not the first.
And I think that's part of why affect theory is a great thing to learn, because I think it's also it's good for compassion, because it makes you want to think about why people react to things the way they do instead of just assuming that they're bad. Affect theory tells us that whatever someone's feeling, they're feeling it for a reason. Nobody is just angry to be angry.
Yeah. And when I finally do my argument with Josh Heath on why the Stoics were fundamentally right about everything, we will go into that in detail. But thank you, Jordan. I'll include a link to that in our show notes. Is there anywhere we can follow you online? Do you talk about your work anywhere, or alternatively, are there any RPG communities you engage with if people have questions?
I'm on the Exalted Discord. I'm in the Mage the Podcast Discord. I imagine some people might argue with this, which I look forward to discussions.
But if we're interested, we can follow up with you on Discord. What's your name there?
So it's Lobsopjoy, and this is the cringiest thing, but it's kind of stuck. It's a Dude, Where's My Car reference. You know, that Ashton Kutcher, Sean William Scott movie from the early 2000s?
Yes.
I just go by Lob, generally. Here, I can type.
So if you do at Lob in our Discord, it will probably L-O-B-S-O-P-D-O-Y.
Yes.
Jordan, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you the best in your academic career.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where we never let our affect affect the effects we affect. This episode has been made possible by Sean Gallagher, Oracle of the Affect of Flatulence. Ben Bendelow, Oracle of the Affect of Not Being Sure If You Need to Sneeze. Buck Gregory, Oracle of the Affect of Wanting to Sing But Possibly Just Needing a Fruit Snack. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the Affect of Wanting to Drum a Really Complicated Drum Part on Your Knee, like some Neil Peart stuff. Guy Stewart, Oracle of the Affect of Wanting to Make a Weird Face to Amuse a Baby. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of the Affect of Jazz Hands. Buku J, Oracle of the Affect of Drawing Your Eyes Narrowly When Someone Says Something Remarkably Dumb. Jay Widener, Oracle of the Affect of Not Being Sure If You're on Fire, Literally. Mikhail, Oracle of the Affect of Ooh, Cake. and the crew of Erebus oracle the affect of how to respond to a sea shanty suddenly happening in the restaurant you're sitting at. Also thank you to Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Bubba the Pale One, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsek, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, as well as Alex, Alexia, Andrews S, Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Frager Rock, George Laura, Henry Kraft, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, John Magnuson, Jolynn Andes, Lols and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leroy Bryce, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Poyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nabarro, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klimanov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Schnabelta Krieger, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, William Martin, and Zach Rules. Our EP shout-out this episode is to Sean Gallagher, and I want to say that I wanted ChatGPT to write a snazzy outro, and I got something about the history of carbon granule microphones, and it was frankly better than what I normally do, so I skipped it because I was intimidated. Then I asked for famous people named Sean and just got actors like Sean Connery, Sean Bean, Sean Astin, and noted Mage fan Sean Combs, a.k.a. P. Diddy. I just assume he likes Mage. This was boring, so I then asked famous Seans that had been murdered, and it couldn't give me any. I then asked for famous Seans that lived to 100, and it couldn't give me any. This has me concerned. If you're not making it to 100 and you're not being murdered, what's happening to our Seans? I think we should investigate. So I turned to ChatGPT. What could be killing our Seans that we don't expect? And I got, the answers were spontaneous human combustion, death by laughter, autoerotic asphyxiation, exploding head syndrome, and death by cow. Now that's what I'm talking about. Thanks, Sean. May you not die by cow. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hopin Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also on Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform you're choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.
I am not. Tell me of this.
There's apparently a specific term for that. I only bring it up because my spouse looks at, like, so I've started moving a bunch of my books, but like, so I have two out of the three that are still populated. And she's like, how does that not make you poop? And I'm like, literally, what are you talking about? But apparently there is this phenomenon whereby smelling a whole bunch of books makes you have to use the little Amazing. Mage's room. Yeah.
Must be an effect.
Yeah. Or an affect.
Yeah. Affect effect.